accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning again. So I'm going to talk about insecurity today, but it's a lovely topic. But before we start, often many Buddhist traditions, especially Tibetan Buddhist traditions, they start every lecture with an acknowledgement of our ancestors. I was reminded of this because Monday is Martin Luther King Day. And so we need to think about our ancestors in terms of the lineage and those that have carried the Soto Zen teaching to us, often through hardship or new countries, not safe. It's not safe to travel to China or to this weird American place and teach the Dharma. I think it was So okay, on that said, trying to bring Buddhism to the United States was like holding a plant to a rock. and also to remember the ancestors of this land and all the people that inspire us and carry us forward. Even though my lecture is not directly about Martin Luther King and the ancestors, I just want to acknowledge that it's important for us to not just see it as a holiday but to remember its meaning for us, each of us. I've been thinking about insecurity and how we practice with insecurity. And the wisdom that can be found in insecurity. If our life is stable, especially if we are those in a culture that have privilege in which our stability is just assumed to be normal, if we have stable lives and we can afford to have a steady roof over our head and enough warm food on cold days and a reasonably stable set of relationships. If our mind and body work pretty well, going along, we can kind of just slide on into a state in which we're actually not aware or not fully aware of all the things that we take for granted. For example, if we wake up in the night to go to the bathroom, most of us can count on our feet taking us to the bathroom without even thinking about it, right? I live my life in two different places. I'm here the bulk of the time, but I'm also in Berkeley part of the time. So sometimes I'll wake up and I don't know where I am. It's like, oh, right, okay, you have to go this way to get to the bathroom. Or if you're traveling a lot, or if you go to a new culture, or all of these ways in which when things are rolling along, we can think, oh yeah, this is just the stability, this knownness is what things are like. Even if it's not comfortable, it can be familiar, right? It's like, okay, this may be feel bad, but it's known quantity. So it sometimes takes an effort, often takes an effort to remember that all things are impermanent. Have you heard that before? And even if we remember, it can be hard to come close to the actual impact that the fluidity of life has on us, in us, in our communities, until something comes along to shake us up, shake up our world. When we step out or are pushed out of the web of knowing, we are confronted with this insecurity, this impermanence, this fluidity. But even if we feel like things are pretty stable, we can cultivate a sensitivity to impermanence. This is good. It's a good practice, right? Because then when the actuality of it comes along, we're not so walloped. It's not like, what? It's like, oh. So we can allow our lives to teach us day by day, how to practice with the reality of the world. So Pema Chodron said, you all know who Pema Chodron is? Anybody not know who she is? Okay. She said, one of the things she said was, life is a good teacher and a good friend. Things are always in transition. If we could only realize it, nothing ever sums itself up in the way that we like to dream about. The off-center, in-between state is an ideal situation. Really? A situation in which we don't get caught and in which we can open our hearts and minds beyond limit. Because when we are discombobulated, that's a technical Buddhist term, then we have to expand. Either that or we contract and fight reality with everything in us. And that's also part of reality. So this is the wisdom of resting in not knowing, of being fully present and not knowing. Not knowing does not mean cluelessness. It means an attitude of receptivity, of curiosity, of openness, of not presuming that we know, which we often do. The question then is how? How do we find a place of rest? When the truth of impermanence hits home, what do we do? When life doesn't follow our carefully hammered out agreements, how do we respond? What is security and insecurity? When I was ordained, my father, who was a businessman, said to me, "What about security?" And my mother turned to him and said, "George, she's looking for a different kind of security." Oh. I thought, go, Mom. I looked up the word secure, and I found that, at least according to the dictionary, it is derived from the Latin word securus. So se means without, and cura means care. So security is a state or an experience that is characterized by being free from care. Insecure is a state or an experience that is not free from care. It's not safe. Or as a dictionary puts it, not adequately guarded. Isn't that interesting? Shaky, uncertain. So we think about the associations that we have with security and insecurity. Security is safe, stable, rock-light. We want our homes to be secure, not when the earthquake comes, kind of fall over. We want our banks to be secure. We want something to feel adequately protected. This is not an unhealthy attitude to have. It's not a problem. When we say something is secured, like on a boat, it means it's safely bound or fixed. Right? It's not flopping around. Insecure, we think of fearfulness, instability, things fly to be, for something not to be secured means it's flying around. It's not adequately protected. So the feeling of insecurity, the feeling, the direct kind of personal experience of insecurity is often one in which things feel unreliable and unsafe. What we thought was solid turns out not to be so. We cannot rely on what we thought we could rely on, right? Mm-hmm. It kind of gets us where we live. So we tend to bounce back and forth between these two experiences, secure to insecure, insecure to secure. We can think of them as opposites on the same dimension. But in that way, both are based in fear. So fear can propel us towards a mirage of security. Then life comes along and throws us a loop. We find ourselves once again faced with impermanence. That's when we have a choice. We always have a choice. Am I going to be driven by fear, by my desire for security at all costs? The security that I've always known, as I've always known it, or am I going to practice with my desire for security? Am I going to turn toward it and open my heart and mind, as the Venerable Pema tells us? At least we might not be able to open our mind and heart without limit, but we can do something. Right. We can do something. So this is a different choice, and it's based on a different way of understanding what we can rely on. A friend of mine a long time ago, a Catholic priest, said people will only let go to the extent that they feel supported. Yeah. So what supports us? What supports us? Who is the us that is supported? If we chase after people or situations that prop up our usual notion of ourselves and security, I think we know deep down that it won't last. There is a feeling that we are fooling ourselves, like whistling in the dark, that circumstances can change in an instant and security can vanish. Think of a tsunami or an earthquake. When we have the support that allows us to experience insecurity, we can do something new. Without that, we can be undone. We cannot find solidity beneath our feet. We're confronted with the question, what can I do? Where can I go? How can I change the situation? Where can I find solidity and safety? These are important questions, and they express an experience of humanness that is deeply humbling. For in fact, we cannot ever, no matter how hard we try, change the nature of reality. This humility is very, very strong and very, very supportive. There is nothing to prop up in this humility. There's no arguing with reality with this humility. This isn't humbleness that's another self-definition, one centered around negative qualities or resignation. It's an admission of the human condition. Thomas Merton said, humility is being completely who you are. Think about that. Humility is being completely who you are. That means you're human. You live in this world, not another world. So there's no fight. That's an incredibly strong position to take. So we are that. Death is perhaps the fact that most brings home the fundamental insecurity. In the Tibetan tradition, which the Venerable Pema Chodron is a part of, as they say, the fact of your death is certain, only the time is uncertain. Could be today. Could be tomorrow. Are all of you familiar with T.S. Eliot? Well, he has something to say about humility. In the middle, not only in the middle of the way, but all the way, in a dark wood, in a bramble, on the edge of a grimpen, there is no secure foothold. The only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless. The only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless. That's the kind of humility I'm talking about. So, humility has threaded in it a respect of oneself and one's practice, a respect of what you have endured in your life, what other people have endured. It's a sturdy position. It's a respectful position. It's a position of great stability. It's a willingness to let go of our ideas, of our cherished notions, and open up to a real experience and admit not knowing. Suzuki Roshi said, "If you have a humble attitude, you will have a true understanding of the teachings. The teaching is there." If you have a humble attitude, you will have a true understanding of the teachings. The teaching is there. He emphasized, Suzuki Roshi, I was going through, we have some of his transcripts, so it's fun to hear his words in their raw sense, not after they've been polished up, but anyway. So, Suzuki Roshi emphasized day-by-day effort. Because what else is there, really? I mean, moment by moment, are you going to... Does effort happen tomorrow? Maybe, but you don't know that. You can't say, well, I'll... I was like, what was that... that guy on the cartoons that say, if you buy me a hamburger today, I'll pay you on Tuesday? Wimpy. Yeah. What was it?
I will gladly pay you Thursday for a hamburger today.
Yeah, see. Isn't that what we negotiate with reality? We say, I will gladly pay you on Thursday for a hamburger today. See, if we have we're laughing because there's a warm-heartedness when we recognize that. That's our human statement. We do that. Like, oh, tomorrow. We'll make the effort tomorrow. But the only place our life can live is in this moment, not tomorrow. The only place our effort can be is in this moment, not tomorrow. And it doesn't have to be some big deal. It's humble. It's steady. I was talking to a friend of ours, another Zen teacher, and he said, you know, the thing about Zen teachers is we may not be brilliant, but we're stubborn. We're tenacious. So Suzuki Roshi said, a little fire is still a little fire. A little fire is still fire. It doesn't have to be some glorious giant bonfire. A little fire is still fire. He said, in this world, we live by constant effort. Isn't that true? Even though gains are small, the act of sincerely trying to improve little by little is salvation. Shanti Deva says the same thing. Our salvation, our freedom, our transformation is in the vow, in the effort. And that's not about breaking rocks, you know. It's just about being present, being humble, being aware. In this world, we live by constant effort. Even though gains are small, the act of sincerely trying to improve little by little is salvation, a way to transcend the troubles. The Buddhist way is the way of eternal effort. True eternity is not contrasted with momentary. True eternity is the eternal present. Eternity is not endless linear time. It's vertical. This endless moment connected with everything in this moment. There is nothing that is hidden, nothing that is other. So our humility is about that, being in that, of that. When he says we transcend, he doesn't mean we flee or enter into some realm. One of my ongoing frustrations is this definition of Zen is like serene, you know, popping out of reality into some kind of cloud realm where nothing bothers you. It's like, where did they get that? I don't know. It's some weird cockeyed notion. So then people think when they sit down, they're just like, well, surely tomorrow I'll have a better period of zazen, right? If I keep at it, surely I'll be sincere and I won't think anymore, or wrestle with things, or my legs won't hurt, or whatever. It's just nonsense. So when he says transcend troubles, he does not mean that we go to this mythical place. He does not mean we find some ultimate security. No. He's pointing to a way of being in which we experience the totality of what we are. Not bound by our problems. Not defined by our problems. We're not failing when we feel insecure. Insecurity then becomes a dharma gate. You know, we say dharma gates are boundless. Well, this is a whopper of a dharma gate, that feeling of insecurity. Humility then becomes a path, a way of encountering with wisdom and strength. So when we turn toward the experience of insecurity in this way, when we practice with our desire for security, instead of working to kind of just satisfy it with empty calories, so to speak, we're making a choice to transform the basis of our lives. Very bedrock. Even just a little, even for just a moment, it makes a difference. Even just a moment. And what we find is that we can rely on that turning. We can rely on that path of humility. Right there, that is eminently trustworthy, that path of awareness and humility. So we just put one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. Just this moment, just this moment. This is what supports us. This is what allows us to be turned inside out by the practice, to open to the beauty. This is Buddha, really. So what we're asking ourselves is to have a kind of binocular vision. On the one hand, we open directly to life, teaching us the truth about the nature of things, and providing us with opportunity after opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to let go of self-clinging and chasing security. And on the other hand, at the very same time, we need to pay attention to what actually works for us. What actually works for us. And that's where humility comes in. What actually works for us in this moment. Suzuki Roshi said, even though you have problem, which you don't need, which you feel you don't need, or is too much. Actually, what he said was, even though you have problem, which you don't need, which you feel, which you don't need, or is too much. Kind of making it a little smoother. Which you feel too much. Right? Even though you have a problem, which you don't need, which you feel you don't need, or is too much, which you feel too much, which you feel too much. But trusting in him, Buddha, you should sit with problems. And at the same time, you should be ready to refuse it if it is too much. But this will not be necessary, you know. There will not be no need to refuse it. Or I would say, there will be no need to refuse it, because more and more the problems you think problem will change into something that you need. Right? So insecurity we can see as a problem. It's a problem for us when we, like, I gotta find this place. But when we turn towards it and practice with it, with humility, which means we don't ignore that gripping, and it becomes a dharma gate, the problem changes into something we need. It opens up to wisdom. Right? He says, so before you sit, before you accept yourself as you are, and before you accept the problem you have, your position, you cannot sit in its true sense. But if you fix your mind, trusting in Buddha, and sit, emphasized, then in it there is no confusion, no problem. So before you sit, before you accept yourself as you are, before you accept the problem you have, your position, this moment, what you are, you cannot sit in its true sense. He's saying you have to accept the whole reality. That one that can be of and accept that whole reality sits zazen. Even when we are sitting, we are like running around, the one who accepts reality is the one who's sitting, whether we know it or not. But if you fix your mind, trusting in Buddha, and sit, then in it there is no confusion, no problem. It doesn't mean we don't have confusion or problems. It means it's all included. That's who we are. What you should do, Suzuki Roshi says, is to wait. Be patient. And wait until you can appreciate your being here. And your being, your position, whatever it is, that is how you practice zazen. That is the spirit of humility that I'm talking about. That is practicing with insecurity and security at the same time. That is being human. Being a being, right? Not just humans, but any being.
Did you read that last part again?
What? Just the last couple sentences?
Suzuki Roshi
part. Well...
just the last sentence you read of his.
What you should do is wait. Be patient and wait until you can appreciate your being here and your being, your position, whatever it is. This is how you practice zazen. This is not easy, right? It's endless. Totally endless. It's like Yamada Roshi said, honesty is the most important thing in the practice of zazen. Honesty. You'd think it'd be like, I don't know, flexible hips or something. Honesty. It means the sense of humility and being willing to enter the Dharma gates of this moment as it is. And that takes incredible courage. But we've got it, right? We don't have to go find it. We've got it all right in us. So when we come to know ourselves as we are, including all our wants, our fears, our desires, our aversions, our complexity. And who is this one that knows this other one? Like, you know, it's like when we come to know ourselves. Well, who? How's that work? I mean, we say this stuff all the time. We come to know ourselves. Well, who's the one that's the self that gets known, and who's the one that didn't know already? It kind of doesn't make any sense, and yet we know what that means. But part of what it means is there is who we fundamentally are is not some self that's known. It's way larger than that. So our wants, our fears, our desires, our aversions, our complexity, As we sit with the Dharma gate of insecurity, the Dharma gate of grief, the Dharma gate of our humanness, we don't do it in the hope that we'll somehow figure it all out. You know, like it's a problem to be solved, that if we just kind of get the right recipe, we'll figure it out, everything will be okay. That kind of okayness is not what we're talking about here. We do it in the spirit of participation with reality, in reality. Does this make sense? Knowing that we're not something other than this reality, we enter this Dharma gate of humility in participation with all that is. So as best we can, moment by moment, we don't hide. In Zazen, we sit on cushion with an open mind and heart, knowing that what we see is only part of who we are, because we are also that which sees. We're being taught moment by moment how to wake up. We're being taught how to join the human race, how to join, because we're not ever separate, right? We're being taught who we are beyond our fantasies of security, our ideas of who we ought to be. So we settle down in this place and we realize aliveness in this moment. We are humble. We take the posture of humility. We wake up. We respond in the midst of insecurity and change. And in this way, I think we experience different kind of security. We rely on the practice, we rely on humility, we rely on awakeness. And that is a different posture.